You could make a big difference in an adult's life by volunteering for a couple of hours each week. Action Read trains and provides ongoing support for its volunteers. For more information about volunteering, call 519-836-2759 or visit us online at www.actionread.com. Our building and office are accessible spaces.
Messenger Bird.
Messenger Bird plays home recordings, experimental songwriters, and all manner of sounds from 20th century homes. This bird likes to dance. Please, please, please send your hi-fi, lo-fi, or no-fi recordings to messengerbird@cfru.ca and tune in every Thursday from 4 to 6 p.m. to 93.3 FM CFRU. New adventures in song.
Good afternoon. You're listening to State of the Union, the official radio show for undergraduate students at the University of Guelph on CFRU 93.3. My name is Demetria Jackson, and I am the External Affairs Commissioner for the Central Student Association at the University of Guelph. Today's show is all about promoting Tim Wise, who's an American anti-racist activist and also a phenomenal speaker on race issues, inequality, and white privilege. The CSA decided to bring him on campus this year in a response to all of the hate activity that was going on against people of color last year. Approximately 70% of all of the hate activity that occurred on campus was directed at people of color. And so we wanted to do something really strong to kind of combat that and bring about positive messaging. And so we're starting this this campaign called Take Responsibility. And the whole premise of it is to understand that we all have individual and collective responsibility in ending, different types of inequality and marginalizations in the world, making sure that everyone has equal access and everyone feels safe in the space that they're in and the skin that they're in. And so that is the campaign that's going to be going on year round. And to kick off the campaign, like I said, we've brought in Tim Wise. And he will be coming in this Thursday, October 13th at 5:30 p.m. in Peter Clark Hall. The admission is free for all free for all University of Guelph students. Non-University of Guelph students and community members are asked to pay what they can on a $2 to $5 sliding scale. We tried to keep it as affordable as possible. We understand, everyone has different financial abilities. And we want to keep it as accessible as possible. If you have Facebook, you can go to the CSA and CJ Munford Center Present Tim Wise, and that is the Facebook event. So we're going to just jump right into it. We're going to play a pretty lengthy clip of one of his talks on white privilege. And if this interests you, I encourage you to come out on, again, Thursday, October 13th at 5:30 p.m. in Peter Clark Hall, which is the basement of the University Center. It's going to be a really amazing event and really inspiring, and we hope as many people come out to it as they can. All right, here we go.
I want to thank you all for coming out. I want to start off by telling you that I think it is probably a good idea, and I try to give this advice at most of my talks, it's probably a very good idea when somebody stands in front of you and is proclaimed by virtue of their bio and by virtue of their curriculum vitae, their resume, that part of which is read to you, by way of the nice comments made about them by others, proclaimed to be an expert. It's probably a very good idea to ask yourself why it is that you're listening to that person and not somebody else. In this culture, we are led to believe that if someone stands before you, a proclaimed expert, that it must be because they are indeed the brightest bulb in the box, that they know something that the other people don't know. I am not standing in front of you, and you are not listening to me because I am the most informed person in the country on racism or white privilege, not because I am the best speaker on those subjects. I am fairly good, and I intend to demonstrate that to you amply in the next hour. It is not because I am the best writer on the subject, though I am okay with that as well. It is instead because I, and I know this, fit the aesthetic that is needed on too many campuses and too many communities around the country in order to come in and to give this talk. Nothing that I am going to say tonight, or at least very little, originated in my head. Nothing, or at least very little, of what I say tonight is in fact new. Almost every single thing that I'm going to say this evening is wisdom that has been shared with me either patiently or sometimes not so patiently by people of color who have in almost every instance forgotten more about the subjects of racism and white privilege since breakfast yesterday than I will likely ever know. And yet they will not be asked to give 85 engagements around the country this year or next on this subject, not because they have not the wisdom to do it, but because privilege, the subject that I'll deal with tonight, bestows upon me that advantage. And so as a matter of responsibility and accountability, I have to own that up front so that when you go away from this evening thinking to yourself, my goodness, that was good. And I'm sure that's my subliminal way to tell you, you're going to think it's just great. And when you go away from here thinking that I have filled your heads with all this great knowledge and wisdom, please know that it is not mine. And the next time you hear it from a person of color, the next time it is shared with you, for those in the audience, particularly who are white, the next time it is shared with you by a person of color, as it will be and as it has been in one form or another, please listen to it. And please know that it is from that source that I get virtually all of my material. We will know that we have made progress only on that day when a person of color can get up and give the talk that I'm about to give and be taken half as seriously as I expect to be taken. It's interesting to see so many people come out to these events, because to hear some people tell it, you would think that this conversation was almost wholly unnecessary. To pay attention to the American political process and what the candidates for this nation's highest office have to say and not say about the issues that are of importance to them, and thus we are to presume importance to the nation, you would get the impression that the issue of race, that the issue of racism, that the issue of discrimination, and certainly that the issue of white racial privilege were non-existent issues, that they were of really no importance or very little importance, because you will not hear and have not heard any of the candidates for presidency of the United States in either party of whatever political ideology make this an issue. Yes, they talk about poverty, and occasionally they talk about schooling and education. They talk about health care. They talk about all of those things, but not once have any of those candidates tried to directly connect the role that racism, the role that racial discrimination, the role that institutional racial oppression and white privilege play in regard to health care, in regard to housing, in regard to schooling, in regard to poverty. It is as if those issues exist in a vacuum and have no relationship to color, have no relationship to race, have no relationship to a history of racial subordination. What does it say about our nation's political process and about our nation's political and social culture that none of these candidates for office has seen fit to tell the American public the following things, all of which you would think would be campaign issues of some importance, at least to some people, and yet they won't say them? Why is it that none of them mention that it was last year, 2006, not 1996, not 1986, not 1976 or 66, but 2006, which witnessed the highest number of race-based housing discrimination complaints in recorded history? The Fair Housing Act was passed in 1968, the year of my birth, and yet it was not 1968 that witnessed the highest level of discrimination complaints based on race. It was 38 years later. In 2006. What does it say about our culture and the politicians, the choices we have been given for leader of the so-called free world, that none of these candidates sees fit to mention as they talk about healthcare, which subject they do talk about with some regularity? What does it say that none of them have seen fit to mention the research that was published in the American Journal of Public Health in 2004, which had looked at 10 years of excess mortality data for African Americans from 1991 to 2000, looking at the number of black folks who had died above and beyond the number that would have died but for their blackness, in effect, and the social and economic conditions that ascribe and essentially adhere to blackness in this country. And what they found in that study, which received almost no media attention, again, published in an academic journal, not read by the average American, not read by political candidates, read by doctors and people who research the healthcare industry, but that's about it. This study found that between 1991 and 2000, there were almost 1 million black people in this country who died, who would not have died had they merely been white and had the average healthcare quality and access of the typical white person in this country. Had they been living in neighborhoods like white neighborhoods in which the levels of exposure to toxicity had been as low as it is in the typical white neighborhood, as opposed to excess exposure to toxics, pollutants, etc., in black and brown spaces. Almost 1 million excess dead people, in this case, black folks, who wouldn't have died had the system of healthcare access and exposure to toxics been equal between white folks and black folks. How is 1 million dead black people not news? You see, if James Byrd gets dragged to death behind a truck in Jasper, Texas, you will hear about that, and well, you should. If one individual is the victim of a vicious hate crime, you will hear about that, and well, you should. But if nearly 1 million people die, not because of bigotry, not because of hatred, not because of some white supremacist organization, but because of systemic and institutionalized injustice, you will not hear anything. How is it not news, and why are no candidates mentioning that according to the Department of Justice, in a study released in 2004, black and Latino males are 3 times more likely than white males to have their cars stopped and searched for drugs, even though white males are 4.5 times more likely to actually have drugs on us on the occasion when we are stopped? Now think about that. Because that suggests that racial profiling is not just racist, we know that, that is redundant. But it's also pretty stupid-ass law enforcement. Or is it? Because I guess it's only stupid if you think the purpose of the war on drugs is actually to get drugs off the street. Because if that were the purpose, putting aside whether or not we ought to deal with a medical and a health problem known as drug addiction with war metaphors in the first place, different lecture for a different night. Even if we assume that that is a good policy, let us be clear that that is not what we're fighting. We're not fighting a war on drugs, because the first rule of any war is to go where the enemy is. And if the white folks are the ones with the drugs in the car, and the black and brown folks are the ones getting stopped, the people fighting this war are either supremely stupid or just have, you know, really bad short-term memory. Like, they keep forgetting, oh, damn, I pulled over another guy named Martinez. Keep forgetting it's white people. Damn it, I got to write a note and put it on the dashboard. I don't know what's wrong with me. Maybe that's it, you know? Or maybe it's something else. I do trainings with law enforcement, not a hell of a lot, for reasons you can probably guess. And I ask law enforcement officers, what's the first thing you think when you see a young black or Latino male driving a nice car in your neighborhood? And they all, without fail and without exception, will say drug dealer. I then ask them, what's the first thing you think when you see a young white male, same age, driving the same kind of car in that same community? And they will say, without exception, without hesitation, without fail, spoiled little rich kid, daddy probably bought him a car. Keep in mind, we have been together for about 90 seconds of the workshop at this point. We have 2 hours left, and they have just outed themselves as racist, because what they have said is that they are making snap judgments on the basis of only color that work to the detriment of people of color, the benefit of white people. We still got 2 hours to go, so you know it's going to be fun from that point forward. These are people sworn to protect and to serve. It's right there on the car, right there on the side of the car. And in the first 90 seconds, they are acknowledging these racial biases. How is that not an issue? How is it not an issue that, according to that Justice Department report, while black and brown folk are having their wheel wells ripped apart on the side of the road, their trunks splayed open, their Dashboards ripped apart in the search for drugs which aren't even there. White people like me. Notice, I said like me because I'm not trying to tell you anything about me that you don't need to know and for which the statute of limitations has not yet expired. Are driving by the roadblock with a trunk full of weed. And we're just waving. Because we're not suspected, therefore we're not detected, therefore we're not punished. How is that not an issue? How is it not an issue that the typical white family in America, thanks to this history, this legacy of institutionalized oppression for some and advantage and privilege for others, how is it not news that the average white family in America, not the average rich white family, the average white family has 12 times the accumulated net worth of the average African-American family, 8 times the accumulated net worth of the average Latino family, in large measure because those white average families have had parents or grandparents who, even if they didn't have much, even if they were not rich, nonetheless were able to procure a little house, a little property, maybe with an FHA or a VA loan in the middle of the 20th century, loans that were all but off limits to people of color as they gave hundreds of billions of dollars worth of assets and equity to those who were white. So that even white working class families on average, even white families with less than $15,000 a year in annual income, which depending on family size, that is technically, legally the poverty limit. And yet the average white family with low income, less than $15,000, has the same average net worth as the typical black family with $60,000 or more in annual income. So that even those African-American families that are professional, good jobs, occupational status, good educations, etc., and pretty good incomes are still in worse shape in terms of wealth and assets, material goods, which are really what matter in the long run, your income. If you're dependent on that, you're one paycheck away from nothing. If you don't have assets, if you don't have wealth, if you don't have something accumulated, your income means very little. In the case of an economic downturn, and these working class white families who are struggling, make no mistake about it, nonetheless are on average going to be better off than those black families with 4 times as much annual pay. How can that not be an issue? I am suggesting to you that the failure to talk about race, the failure to talk about racism and inequality on the basis of color, feeds the denial that is already far too prevalent among the white community. And having been white all of my life, I've been surrounded by that denial for a very long time. A few years back, white Americans were asked whether or not we believed that racial discrimination was still a significant national problem for people of color, or whether it was just a problem, you know, like junk mail, wrong phone number, 2 in the morning, you can't get back to sleep, it's raining and you want to go outside for a jog, you know, a problem, but one you'll get over, you know. Whether it wasn't much of a problem, wasn't a problem at all, we just weren't sure. They also asked black and brown folk this question. Folks of color, it won't surprise you, said, yes, it is a significant problem, actually, and not just because I read about it in a sociology textbook. I actually have lived it and would be more than happy to tell you what kind of problem it's been, but these were pollsters, man. They didn't care about that. They just wanted the yes or no, then they were on to the next house. And they asked white folks, is it or is it not a significant national problem, racial discrimination for people of color and against people of color? And only 6%, 6 out of 100 said yes, that it was a significant national problem. Just to give you an idea of how bad that is, I would have you compare it to a survey taken a few years earlier where approximately 12% of white Americans said we believe there was a fairly decent chance that Elvis Presley might still be alive. I don't know how good you are at math. I'm not very good myself, but that's a ratio that I can calculate. What that means is that white Americans are twice as likely to believe that Elvis might still be alive than we are to believe what people of color tell us they experience on a fairly regular basis. That is denial so profound as to boggle the mind, but there it is. And the people who are saying it are not mean-spirited, they're not hard-hearted, they're not bad people. I firmly believe that most people are good people. I could be wrong about this, but I have 2 little girls, ages 6 and 4, and I choose as a parent to believe that most people are good. If you have evidence of the contrary, keep it to yourself. I do not want to know it or hear it this evening. What I do know is that those individuals who said that, as well-meaning as they may have been, that they really didn't see it as a significant problem, aren't new in their denial. See, it's one thing for young people to think that the problem is solved. I almost get that. I almost understand it, because if you're under the age of 25, maybe even under the age of 35, what you know, what we tend to know, younger people, about this history and about this legacy is what we see in that grainy black and white footage every MLK Day, or maybe during Black History Month. If I were to ask you, do you believe that folks of color had equal opportunity and were treated equally in this country in 1963? Or whether or not black children were treated equally in schools and had equal educational opportunity in 1962, I know right now that no one in here would say, well, of course, you know, naturally they did. 1963, that was a damn good year to be black or brown in America. What are you talking about? Everyone, regardless of your position about 2007, would quickly acknowledge how bad it was back in the day, because it's no sweat off your back. 44, 45 years later, it's easy to talk about how bad it was. But now, see, here's the trick. What do you think white folks said when those very questions were put to them in 1963 and in 1962? At a time when the apartheid system in this country was very much in full effect. It was before the Civil Rights Act, before the Voting Rights Act, before the Fair Housing Act. In retrospect, we can all look back and say how profoundly unequal it was. How profoundly unequal it was. And yet when white folks were asked, some of them our parents, our grandparents, great uncles, great aunts, these ancestors of ours, right, were asked the very same question in 1963. Do you think that people of color, they didn't use that term, it said racial minorities. Do you think that racial minorities are treated equally in your community? And 80% of white folks said yes. In 1962, when Gallup asked, do you think that black children receive equal educational opportunity in your community? 90% approximately of white folks said yes. Nothing to see here. What is all this complaining? What is this march on Washington? I don't get it. I don't understand it. In fact, the very month of that march, which now it seems like every white liberal wants you to believe they were at, the very month of that march, white folks were asked by Newsweek what they thought about it. They said two-thirds of whites said that Dr. King and the movement were pushing too far, too fast, asking for too much, and too soon. The idea that this country was ready to hear this, even at the time when we know how vicious it was, is a lie. What does it say that white folks were in denial in 62 and 63? What does it say that if you've gone back to the 30s and asked the question, you think white folks were clear then? The 1890s, what did white folks say? Those southern editors of newspapers where I'm from, they would say, well, we get along fine with our Negroes down here if you Yankees would just leave us alone and stop messing in our business. Go back to 1850 and read what Dr. Samuel Cartwright, a well-respected member in good standing of the medical profession in this country, said. Not only was racism not a problem, there wasn't even a word for that yet, slavery wasn't a problem, so much so that he decided that any slave who would run away obviously had a mental illness. Because you'd have to be crazy to run away from bondage. So he came up with a term, he called it drapetomania. Don't even know what the root of that is, don't want to know, don't understand where the word came from, but that's what he called it, drapetomania. You must be crazy, you must be mentally ill to run away from your loving master. Denial. In every generation, 2007, 1963, the 30s, the 1890s, the 1850s, my point being that in every generation, members of the dominant group have said there is no problem. And in every generation, without fail, we have been wrong. And in every generation, people of color, those who were the targets of that oppression and subordination, have said there is a problem. And in every generation, without fail, they have been right. So the question for us today is, what are the odds, honestly, that people of color who have never gotten it wrong have suddenly lost their frickin' minds and have suddenly become unable to see truth and to separate it from fiction? And counter to that, what are the odds that white folks who have never gotten it right yet have suddenly become highly, highly perceptive? The odds are pretty long. And again, it's not because white folks are insensitive or hard-hearted, let alone stupid, but it is that those of us who are white have the luxury of not knowing black and brown truth. We don't know because we don't have to know. We are not tested on it. If I don't know what people of color experience, what happens to me in this country? Virtually nothing. But if people of color don't know my reality, if people of color don't know white reality, better than white folks have to know it. If they cannot regurgitate it to us better than we would ever be able to regurgitate it to ourselves, all hell breaks loose. So people of color are going to have to know white history, white literature, white art, white theater, white poetry, white drama. I know we don't call it that. That's sort of the point. When your stuff is the stuff against which everybody else's stuff is compared and found lacking, you don't have to name it. It's just the norm. That's why, for those still confused, we don't have White History Month, because we have several. They go by the tricky names of May and June, July, August, September, pretty much any month that we have not designated as someone else's month. That's White History Month. But we take it for granted because we don't have to know other folks' reality. That's a privilege. That's an advantage. That's a head start. And it's one we must think about. See, that's the other piece of this, right? It's one thing for white folks to acknowledge racism. Because, you know, white liberals will. God bless them. White liberals will acknowledge that racism is real. Oh, my goodness, we should do something about that. Yes, yes, we should. It's terrible, that racial profiling, that housing discrimination. My goodness, it's awful. Yes, yes, it is. But just because we acknowledge racism and discrimination doesn't mean that we'll necessarily acknowledge the flip side of that. Doesn't mean that we will acknowledge that for everyone who's targeted by that discrimination, which we're willing to admit exists, there is somebody else not being targeted, guess whom? And that those individuals are elevated by definition and receive an advantage, receive a subsidy, receive a privilege in the process. You see, we like to talk about those who are down as if there is no up, right? We like to use language that obscures the interrelationship of down and up. Now, down has no meaning without an up. It is a relative term. But we talk about those at the bottom of the hierarchy, not paying attention to the fact that for anyone who's down, someone is above them, and they're above them because they're down. We use this language that makes it impossible. And when I say we, I don't mean like right-wing folk. I'm not even talking about them. I'm talking about nice, liberal, caring service providers. Right? People who just want to help. Right? I just want to help the underprivileged. That's the word we use. I've used it before. I don't use it anymore, except in a speech like this. Right? We just want to help the underprivileged. But what's wrong with that word, folks? At least two things that ought to be pretty obvious to you, right? Number one is it's a passively constructed term, right? It's the passive voice, as my English teacher would say. Underprivileged doesn't imply that anybody did anything to anyone.
Unfortunately, that's all we have for today. If you want to hear more about Tim Wise, you can come out to our event on Thursday, October 13th, this Thursday, at 5:30 p.m. in Peter Clark Hall. It's free admission for University of Guelph students. Non-University of Guelph students and community members, we're asking to pay what they can on a $2 to $5 sliding scale. We're still trying to keep it pretty affordable. Yeah, so if you want to check out more information, go check out our Facebook event. You can find it by typing in CSA and CJ Munford Center present Tim Wise. You can also find him on YouTube if you want to just listen to him speak a little bit more on race issues. And if you want more information just generally about the CSA, you can email csaext@uofguelph.ca. Again, my name is Demetria Jackson, and I'm the External Affairs Commissioner for the Central Student Association, and you're listening to State of the Union on CFRU 93.3. Have an awesome day.
CFRU's news team needs intrepid reporters to hit the streets and uncover the headlines that matter to our community. Absolutely no experience necessary. Get involved. Drop by CFRU, second floor of the University Center, Tuesdays at 5:30 p.m. For more information, email news@cfru.ca.
Because you're listening to CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph, campus and community radio.
No control.
The There are 29 days to vote in this provincial election. Students in Guelph can vote for their home electoral district by special ballot at the returning office at 292 Speedvale Avenue, starting September 8th until October 5th.